Mitzvah Reish Samech, Hey 265. Shelo Yishamesh Kohen Tevul Yom, that a priest who was immersed by day, we'll see what that means, Ad She'yariv Shimsho, until his sun sets. Okay, so what do these things mean? Shelo Yishamesh Kohen Tevul Yom, Ad She'yariv Shimsho, V'afal Pi She'toval V'toher, Sarich Harev Shemesh. That we have a concept in halacha that for certain types of tuma and things that require non tuma, those are not the source sheets for this year. So sometimes going to the mikvah is not the be all and end all. Sometimes in order to attain full purity, you need the end of the day as well. In other words, you immerse in the afternoon, say, or in the morning, whatever, but you don't become fully pure until nightfall. So you have the status of a sheni latuma, a secondary transmission of ritual impurity, until the setting of the sun. It doesn't literally mean sunset, we'll see later. Shekein perishu zichronam levracha, b'mayim yuva v'tamei ad ha'erev v'taher. That a person shall be immersed in water, and then shall be impure until the evening, and shall become fully pure. So we have a problem. The person went to the mikvah, but yet the Torah still calls this person Tomei to a certain extent. So what does that mean? So the person is now reduced in level of ritual impurity, but still maintains some of it. So the person is not impure the way he or she was before the immersion. Kimitchila haya rishon l'toma. So first you're a Rishon L'Tuma, or maybe an Avatuma. You're a higher level of Tuma, and then you reduce your status after you go to the mikvah. They shall not desecrate the name of their God. So what does this mean? It says over here in Parshas Emor, they should not desecrate the name of their God. So what's this referring to? They shall be holy to their God, and they should desecrate the name of their God. So, what do you mean? Is it talking about worshipping at the base of Mikdash in a status of real tumah, of full ritual impurity? That can't be. That's already been discussed. It already says that that's a problem. So, no. Tenehu inyan l'tvul yom sheshimish. V'yalif lahasam. Mechilul chilul, and he learns out the punishment over there. The fact that it says chilul by truma, which also requires harav shemesh, the official sanctified foods that are eaten only by the kohanim, also require not just immersion in the mikvah, but at the end of the day of the immersion as well. So the same thing too over here. This pasuk, which cannot be used for someone who's fully tamei, is instead used for a tvul yom. That even if you went to the mikvah, you're still not allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash until Harav Shemesh, until nightfall. Mishorshi HaMitzvah, Lefisha Kohen Hu HaShliach Ben Yisrael Aviyem Sheva Shamayim. The priest is a messenger between the Jewish people and their Father in Heaven. Umitoch Masa V'Korbanosa V'Yisratze Ha'odam Lefi Boro V'Yechu Paravono. So that based on the actions of the Kohen, the affects the whole the forgiveness process, the atonement process of the Jewish people. You have to be super, 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 super pure while you're performing the worship in the Beis HaMikdash. You need a little bit of cool-off time. So you went to the mikvah, so you might think, well, you went to the mikvah, you can jump straight from the mikvah into the Beis HaMikdash. No, you need a little time for the spirit of impurity, so to speak, to leave you entirely. And that is until the end of that day. Uvaruch Adon HaChochma Kiva Yodea V'lo Anachnu Ad Eze Eis Yichshar V'mishnitma Lasach V'avodoso Baruch Hu. He knows what he wants in terms of the worship in the Beis HaMikdash, and he knows how long it takes for this cooling off period. God could have said a week, could have said a month, could have said 1 hour, always 1 hour, it doesn't matter. No, but it's the natural conclusion of the day is the end completely of the period of quasi-tumah. So for certain types of tumah, so this is the time of the setting of the sun. So what does it mean, the setting of the sun? So in halacha, the day ends at Tzeis HaKochavim. So for Shabbos purposes, so we have a stringency. We wouldn't call it a chumrah, because that means that the colloquial terminology, a chumrah is something you don't really have to do, but it's just a stringent ruling that you accept upon yourself, but that's not what it means. We have a stringency that's found in the Gemara, that we have a period called Bein Hashmoshes. We have a period as to whether it's a doubt, we're in doubt as to whether night has fully fallen, according to Halacha, or whether it's still daytime. So different shittas in the Gemara, exactly what this means. According to the famous shita of Rabbi Yossi and the Gemara, Rabbi Yossi says that there really is not much period of Bein Hashmoshes. It's just the blink of an eye before Tzeis HaKochavim, before three medium-sized stars come out, which is how the Gemara defines the halachic nightfall, is Bein Hashmoshes. But this period is obviously very difficult. It's too close for comfort. So we go like the other shitas in the Gemara about what Bein Hashmoshes is. So the different, we go like the shita, at least in terms of stringency, we go like the shita of Rebbe Yehuda, that Bein HaShmoshes starts either shortly after or at sunset. So what exactly sunset is a matter of some controversy, but for Shabbos purposes, we're stringent that sunset means when the top of the ball of the sun goes below the horizon. And it's not clear that all the Rishonim worked with that. It means that many Rishonim were working more with the setting of the light of the sun rather than the ball of the sun itself. But nevertheless, for Shabbos, the accepted practice of all Kol Yisrael now is that we begin Shabbos before. Candlelighting is before this time. We don't even touch this time. That we begin Shabbos at least at the very, very, very latest when the ball of the sun, the top of the ball of the sun, sets below the horizon. Again, you need Tosefes Shabbos, so you de facto have to start it before then. But that strictly, according to Halacha, is what we accept nowadays as when Shabbos begins. But it's very unlikely, more than very unlikely. We know that the halachic daytime really, the halachic days really switch at a period of darkness. So at the exact setting of the sun that we know and love nowadays, that we call Shkia, sunset, doesn't really get dark at all. There's not really any significant difference between before Shkia and after Shkia in terms of darkness. It's just whether you can see the sun or not. So we assume that the real halachic changing of the days occurs when there's some darkness going on over here. So that's why Harav Shemesh in this context is not at all, there's no suffix whatsoever, the Harav Shemesh in this context refers to the setting of the ball of the sun below the horizon. That's just not true. It refers to when it gets dark. And that's defined, that's the setting of the light of the sun, not necessarily the ball of the sun. So that's why here, Harav Shemesh, the way the Torah describes it is Bo HaShemesh, but when the Torah says Bo HaShemesh, it doesn't mean, like I said, what we call sunset. It means that the light of the sun is disappearing. So that's why Harav Shemesh really over here, strictly speaking, means it has to be Tzeis HaKochavim, has to be when the stars come out, because that's what we know, it's nighttime, according to Halacha. But midine hamitzvah, and that's by the way the pshat in the first Mishnah in Maseches Brachos that everybody knows. When is the beginning of the time for reading of the Shema in the evening? When the Kohanim go in to eat their truma, and of course Kohanim require Harav Shemesh in order to eat their truma, which means that it's teaching you the halacha that Harav Shemesh is Tzeis HaKochavim, which is the same time as the Shema can be read in the evenings. Again, sometimes we read it earlier, but it has to be as part of the service in the shul as connected to Tefillas Ma'ariv, which you could have in earlier, according to some shittas. But the main time of reading the Shema is after nightfall, which is why we have to repeat Shema after nightfall when we read it in the shul beforehand. Midine ha-mitzvah, what are the halachos of this mitzvah? So whether you went to the mikvah to purify yourself from Dumas Mace, from a dead body, which of course also requires sprinkling with the ashes of the Paraduma, or you are a Zav or a Zava in Saras, which are really, really Tame, really bad Tumos, even if you just touched a dead Sheretz, one of the species that conveys Tuma, lizards and such, Ta'un Harav Shemesh. You need to go wait till nightfall in order to worship in the Beis HaMikdash, and you're going to the mikvah by itself is not sufficient. V'zeh ha'inyan, hu bein ba'adam, bein b'keilim, bein b'tuma d'raisa, o afilu, b'tuma d'rabanan, tzarech Harav Shemesh. So whether it pertains to a person or to keilim and their use in the Beis HaMikdash or for truma types of purposes, it would need a Harav Shemesh, even if they went to the mikveh during the day. Uperish, they used to take kelim to the mikveh in order to purify them, so you would have a lot more backup. Nowadays, you only have to take a vessel to the mikveh usually once in your life. But in the olden days, you would have to take kelim to the mikveh all the time, because they have to be purified from tumah, as opposed to the raising to Kedushas Yisrael when you first buy it, which is a different institution entirely.
you can do both at once, obviously, right? Because you get a kli, so it's tame. You buy a kli.
Right. Oberish to the Yom, you have bigger lines that you can imagine. We need like five in the neighborhood. Everybody, every Friday, they'd be a backup. Everybody is cooking for Shabbos. Whoops, I forgot to immerse this.
What are they getting tuma from during the week?
No.
What do you mean, anything?
Is there any,
during the base of Mikdash, not now.
Oh.
I'm saying.
Bugs and, whatever.
Yeah, if a lizard falls into your pot, so it becomes tuma. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not talking about kashrus. For kashrus, you just wash the pot off. For tuma, you'd have to.
Operish
tvulyom.
I know you'll
edit that. Kilomar shimsho. So, what does immersed by day mean? That means you went to the mikvah and you didn't reach nightfall yet. Vzeo perusha bechol makom. That's what it always means. Bimnaga beochlin umashkin shel truma posalosan vososan shlishi latuma. So we said that the status of a tvulyom is similar to the status of a sheni latuma. Normally, a person cannot be a sheni latuma. Neither a person is a Rishon Tumah or an Avatumah. Either the Sorcerer Tumah or the first grade person thing that contracted the Tumah. But here it says that Tvul Yom is the lesser status, that even a person can be like a Sheni Tumah. So if you touch Truma, so you make it into a Shlishi Tumah. Lefishu Kesheni Tumah Kemo Shamarnu, which is no good. So a Shlishi Tumah cannot be in as Truma. So if you a Tvul Yom touches Truma, then you the Truma is now out to be eaten. But if this truma touches something else, then it doesn't make that next thing tamei. Third degree tuma is the most that goes by truma, by the Kohen's foods. And the fourth is completely tahar. But what if you eat sacrificial foods, or mashkin, or beverages, asan, revi, Kilomar Shepsolin, but by sacrificial food, so we do have the level of a revi, a fourth degree tuma. So you would invalidate the sacrificial foods from consumption if you touched, if the tvulyom touched it. Aval ein chozrin hein l'tamei achirim. Aval bishashlishi osa revi bekodesh. Tumas tvulyom eina chamura kolkach shetatamei l'revi. So it's interesting. Now normally it's like a sheni, but vis-a-vis sacrificial foods, it turns the thing it touches directly into a revi, into the last level of tuma. So basically, whatever it touches, it turns it into the last possible level of tuma. And the thing that the tulyum touches can now go and be matame something else. So for most things, he's like a sheni latuma, but vis-a-vis kodesh, he'll be considered more like a shlishi latuma, because if he were really a sheni latuma as far as the kodesh were concerned, then if he touched a sacrificial food, then that food touched something else, then it would make it tame. But by a tvulyom, that's not the case. The thing that he touches is the last in the chain of the tuma for sacrificial foods. But regular food that has no sanctity whatsoever, he doesn't affect them at all. Because sheni is the farthest you can go by chulin, so therefore the fact that it would become a shlishi is irrelevant. So there is no shlishi, so it's tahar. This is the received tradition of our sages. So the third degree by truma and the fourth degree by sacrificial foods does not metame something else. So they certainly don't transmit impurity to vessels. So we know that the easiest things to receive ritual impurity are foods and beverages, and vessels and people are generally less susceptible to receiving ritual impurity. So therefore, these things cannot transmit ritual impurity to vessels, and certainly not. Shadim kelim ein mekalim tuma ela me'ava tuma. So a person and kelim only receive tuma from the source of a tuma. So if something was something contracted tuma, so that cannot transmit tuma to a person or to a vessel, only from the source of the tuma itself. So if you have a person whatever type of impurity the person is subject to. So their spit and urine is not considered like a part of their body, but their spit and urine is considered like a beverage that they touched. So in other words, it would be a lesser level of impurity, as it would not be considered part of the source of impurity itself, with the exception of the spit of a zav. These liquids coming out of a zav, if a special xeris agozov, that they would do maintain their impurity. There's an aptly named tractate in Seder Taros called Maseches Tevil Yom, where all the details of a Tevil Yom is discussed. And this mitzvah is applicable only to Kohanim, male Kohanim, during times of Beis Hamikdash. So it doesn't apply to female Kohanim, it only applies to people who are actually performing the worship in the Beis Hamikdash. Even though the Kohanos would be subject, the female Kohanim would be subject to Harav Shemesh for eating Truma, because they can eat Truma. They just don't perform the worship of the Beis Hamikdash. What?
What are female Kohanos?
The daughter of a Kohen. Or the wife of a Kohen could also eat Truma. But an unmarried daughter.
Household.
Right.
Daughter living in the house.
Right. So the Kohen household can all eat Truma. Even the slaves are allowed to eat Truma. Right. They're part of the household. So this rule of Harav Shemesh would apply. Just not for the worship of the Beis Hamikdash, which is this particular mitzvah, Reish Samech Hei. Umishavar al zeh v'shimesh tevil yom chayav misa bidei shemayim. If a Kohen worships tevil yom, then he is going to suffer death at the hands of heaven. It's somewhat unpleasant, but that's the way it goes. Veloba al chiyuv zeh kosu mevor b'torah. The Torah doesn't say this explicitly. Elo shalomdu chacham zirfan al racha inyan sham b'sanhedrin b'gzera shalva dechilul chilul. That the word desecration, chilul, is used both over here and by the Truma. So therefore, since the penalty for Truma is Misa Bidei Shemayim, is death at the hands of heaven, so to here, the penalty for worshipping as a Tevil Yom is also death at the hands of heaven. It's interesting, we have certain cases where a Tevil Yom is allowed to perform certain worships, like the burning of the Parah Aduma. That's the famous case where, with the burning of the Parah Aduma, so it says in the Gemara that the Chachamim, in the times of the Bais, used to intentionally make the Kohen who's burning the Parah Aduma a Tevil Yom, because the Tzdukim, the Sadducees, held that a Tevil Yom couldn't do anything. So the Chachamim, the Prushim, the Pharisees, the progenitors of the Chachamim, of Chazal, is held that a Tevil Yom could do it. So they used to do it specifically. I don't know if they always had the power to do it, but it says in the Gemara that whenever possible, they used to intentionally make this Kohen a Tevil Yom, lahotzi mi liban shel atzdukim, that you should do it, right, in your face, make a point to them that, no, this is absolutely mutter, and we don't go by your Sadducean interpretation. So we have this phrase that's thrown around nowadays, connected with this Tevil Yom business of lahotzi mi liban, that when somebody does something, oh, beshita, then it's lahotzi mi liban. Like in the Volozhin Yeshiva, they used to, on the first night of Pesach, they used to bring bowls of hot water, and they used to take matzah and dip it in the water to show that gebrochts is okay, that it's not a problem. There's no problem whatsoever with gebrochts. That's lahotzi mi liban. It's to remove from the heart, literally, of people who think that it's usur, that by showing that, by demonstrating that it's 100% mutter. You have this also that people, some rabbanim in Europe, when they had both chassidim and misnagdim in their town, you had a misnagid rabbi, so he used to put a bowl of matzah ball soup in the window. Everybody passing by the house should see. Right. Everybody should see that gebrachta's mutter. Which is funny to me that all these misnagdim are so against gebrach, so it's fine that it's so ridiculous and silly and... When you think about it, I mean, I eat gebrach, so I'm not saying that practically halachically that this is the case. But I think of all the crazy things that people do on Pesach, this is one that makes one of them more sense than any of the others. There have been instances where there have been unbaked parts of the matzahs, right, or there have been flour from the bakery that made its way on top of the matzah. Again, if you take care, it shouldn't happen. You should make gebrach sanjeres and mutter. But it is a more, seems to me, in certain situations, a more reasonable Hashash, yes, than other things that we have nowadays. But like kidney on Pesach nowadays, There's really no chashash, especially oils, kidneys. It's really far fetched nowadays. In the olden days, it wasn't, but that means it's too late. They accepted it on themselves already, but it seems much more far fetched than gibbruxes or other things.
Actually, touches, let's say, a dish. If you hold it for a year and don't use it, which you.
What do you mean, touches? Hot?
All right, let's say hot.
Yeah.
Then what? Can you use those dishes the following year?
Yes, kosher.
You mean if you can't kosher?
Let's say there's a shash, and in fact, there was a piece of the matzah that was not fully baked, and it touched your plate. Can
so you we don't. There, the Chacham Tzvi, there is a. For people learned that with Azara. There is a concept that for wine, amphorae, which are clay, earthenware, things that use to store wine, so we know that these things are not subject to the normal rules of kashrus. So, for example, if you have something that's used to store wine, then you cook something kosher, and that non-kosher wine, you cook something kosher in it, even if the thing hadn't been used in 24 hours, it's still it's still not kosher because the taste of the wine is still pungent. It doesn't. A normal vessel, there's a tiny bit of stuff absorbed in it, if anything at all, and whatever is left after a day is considered to be no longer really fit for consumption, so it's not going to forbid something else to go cooked in the pot. That's why if the pot hasn't been used in 24 hours and was used for a treif before then, if you cook something kosher, so it still remains kosher under normal circumstances. But it doesn't apply to wine. So it says that if you left the wine vessel dormant for a year, for 12 months, so that's sufficient for the stuff in the wine vessel, the wine vessel to break down and become inedible, and then if you put something kosher in that wine vessel now, so then it would be, okay, so the Chacham Tzvi, who is an interesting character, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's father, so he says that applies to all vessels, that if you leave a vessel for a year unused, then it doesn't need to be kashered, which is very difficult. Very difficult. Why should it apply to any other vessels? Aliyah, you shouldn't need to kasher it, that it should be completely, that the taste that's absorbed in the vessel is completely broken down. So most poskim completely reject this. They say you always need to kasher, even if it hasn't been used in 300 years. If it was once used hot for treif, then you have to kasher it. But you have, sometimes, we use the Chacham Tzvi's opinion when there is a very difficult situation.
Your
like
grandmother's china.
Right, the classic case is by your grandmother's china. So let's say, so if you don't know whether she kept kosher, or how kosher she kept, or whether it was milchik or fleishik or pesach or regular, then if if it's a case of loss, and you know you want to throw out a very very expensive set of china or has great sentimental value or something, so in that case we would allow you to use it for pesach or otherwise if you waited a year. Yeah, it's not something we rely on the chatchila. Certainly, if something can be kashered, so you have to kasher it.
China.
Some say also, some rely on other situations also.
China, you don't have to kosher after a year.
What Rabbi Simon probably means is that in contemporary China, the glaze is glass, is really made of glass.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really absorb anything at all.
You hold it up and you can see it.
Right, if it's chipped, then you might have a problem. But if the glaze is complete, so for Pesach, we don't rely on glass. For other Isurim, so according to most poskim, even Ashkenazim, are allowed to use glass for both milchiks and fleishiks, and it doesn't matter. Again, I wouldn't recommend. I still don't recommend. I always say this footnote when I give my leniencies about glass. I wouldn't recommend using something in a kli rishon for both milchiks and fleishiks that's made of glass, like a Pyrex Pyrex baking tray or something. I wouldn't recommend using that both for milchiks and fleishiks. It's very hard to clean properly, and a kli rishon, more chamor, that's really, really bolea. Again, probably the glass doesn't absorb anything at all. Nevertheless, because of these concerns, so I don't recommend, and you'll get confused and mixed up, so I don't recommend using a kli rishon that's mamish used to cook
for both milk and pleasure. So what is the upshot as far as, you know, the chomets touching?
Plates? What do you mean?
The glass.
Well, first of all, in your case, where you weren't sure that chomets touched it, it was just the concern that you had that maybe Chametz touched it, so that would be a room to rely on the Chacham Tzvi. Because you're not going outright and saying, I'm using it after a year and I'm not koshering it. Maybe, so out of concern, we'll wait a year and... Yeah.
But if you know for sure...
Depends on the situation. Uh-huh. Depends on the situation. Maybe you could add the fact that maybe it wasn't polea because of the glaze, and maybe you could then end the 12 months, and maybe you could do some sort of rudimentary kashering, even though we assume that normally doesn't work for earthenware. There are ways to work with it.
Putting matzah, let's say, into hot liquid does not produce chash even?
No.
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 No. Oh, almost like we don't assume that, unless you see flour sitting on the surface of your matzah.
Yeah, really, it's not what, you know, properly prepared matzah, in which case you shouldn't have it around at all. No, of course, that's kaprox, and that's all.
But there have been times where there were problems with matzah bakeries, that their flour was making its way onto the baked matzahs or parts of the matzah. They used to make matzah also. The matzah ovens that we have nowadays for hand matzah are very, very hot, like 900 degrees. So sometimes when you make the matzah particularly thick, and you just stick it in the oven, and for the normal thin matzahs, it sits in the oven for 30 seconds, and that's normally enough to bake it completely. But if you make the matzah very, very thick, and the normal person who's normally shoveling the things into the oven and taking them out, and they don't pay attention to the fact that it's so thick, and they stick it in the oven, and then they take it out after, like a normal matzah, after 30 seconds, and so it could be not really baked inside.
So it's really preferable to buy thin matzahs. I mean, they taste a whole lot better, too.
Thin doesn't mean it has to be paper thin, but if you see your matzahs are this thick, then maybe it's not good, unless people are trained to do that. So Svaradim Teimanim, who have a Mesorah, have had a bake...
Kind of matzah.
Right, if they bake thick matzah that's soft, they cook it at a somewhat lower temperature. Can't be too low, but a slightly lower temperature, and they know how long to keep it in to make sure it's fully baked, even at that thickness, and it stays soft. But if they have a normal thick matzah that you find to be this thick, then... No good.
Before we leave the subject of koshering things in unusual ways, what's the whole thing about burying knives and forks or something like that, or
sticking them in dirt,
sticking knives in dirt or burying anything?
That's a good question. Certainly, according to the halacha that we know and love from rabbinical school, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No.
But the truth is I haven't fully looked into it. I remember one of my first Safra's teachers, who teaches in YU, a very colorful character, Rabbi Schneid, lives in Muncie. So he said that he is very into minhagim. He says that Jewish women know better how to do Judaism than all the rabbis.
They probably do.
Sometimes true. Not necessarily always, but I believe in respecting traditional practice. He says that all the rabbis nowadays say that's ridiculous. You don't stick cutlery in when it becomes treif in flower pots or dirt or whatever.
Clean it. Sand,
that's a different thing. When there's a knife that might have treif residue on it, so you stick it 10 times in earth.
It's like sandpaper.
Right. Right. Some say nowadays steel wool is okay for that also.
Oh, I bet it is.
Because it's fully abrasive. It doesn't. Maybe our soap and sponges, maybe they work okay. But normally the poskim say you can use maybe steel wool instead of sticking it in ground 10 times. But that's different. That's just 10 times like this. That's not leaving it sitting in a flower pot. So Rabbi Schneid said that he did find a source for sticking in flower pots. Again, I have to follow up with him.
No.
That's at the end with the sticking in.
Wow.
You're talking about the sticking in 10 times in order to clean the knife.
Rabbi Schwartz said,
it's talking about buying things from... No, talking about kashering. It's the last part of Avodah Zarah talks about kashering. Stuff that you buy from non-Jews. Avodah Zarah talks about relationships between Jews and non-Jews.
That's how it makes its way into the tractate.
So I can't tell you I have a good answer, but... Rabbi Schneid claims that there is some source for it. And if you're talking about a klisheni also, so it's more kal, you're talking about a knife or a fork that's normally not used directly on the fire, so then it's used in a klisheni, maybe it's not usually hayad soledesbo anymore, so maybe that has to do with it. I don't know. I'll have to talk to him and if I can find the exact source, but this is...
Is he still around?
He's still alive? I think so.
I mean, I never heard of him, so...
So he's, because it seems not to make any sense, because if something absorbed by hot, so it needs to be kashered by hot, just sticking it in the ground and letting it sit there and to grow flowers.
It has nothing to do with the fact that you can't really kasher, sometimes you can't kasher the handle.
Well, if you can't kasher, they should be able to kasher by sticking in the ground either. But this was a known practice that many Jewish women, otherwise very observant, did this, and it's not clear exactly why, so I have to look into it.
I remember seeing it in my own house.
I'm sure you did. Not surprised. Fine. Mitzvah Reish Samech Vav, Mitzvah 266. Shelo Yisa Kohen Isha Zona. That a Kohen should not marry a harlot. So what's a harlot? Not what you think. Shelo Yisa Kohen, a Kohen should not marry Ben Kohen Gadol, Ben Kohen Hediyot, any type of Kohen. Isha Zona Lisha. You should not marry a harlot. Shenemar Isha Zona V'chalolo Yikachol. You should not take a harlot or a chalolo, which we'll see what that is later. The Loshon Kicha Mashma Derech Ishus. It's not just that they decide to have an affair. It's that they actually get married. You have to marry her, and then they have to have relations afterward. Just having relations is not sufficient for the Kohen to transgress this prohibition, which, by the way, not everyone agrees to. The Minchas Chinuch brings different shitas on exactly what is required. In any event, the Chinuch is here going with the shita of the Rambam, that you require both marriage and relations, and one alone is not sufficient, which other shitas might disagree with.
Plegish wouldn't
count. That opens the door.
According to this, not, yeah.
To mistresses.
Yeah.
Why? You're not allowed to have a mistress. Just maybe the Cohen wouldn't violate this technical prohibition.
Right, it's this thing. There's plenty of other things you're going to violate, not this,
Shekein ba perush enachiyov ad shivalena. Even if you get married, it doesn't. The Kohen is not chayiv unless they actually have relations. Kemoshen nichtov bezra sayel, as we'll write later on. Mishor she amitzvah. So maybe even they have nisuin. So we know that if the second stage of marriage is completed, so the woman is now no longer considered to be a virgin for halachic purposes. So, for example, if they have the second stage of marriage, they go into yichud together. Different shittas about exactly what nisuin is, but the marriage ceremony is completely over. They have absolute nisuin. They go home together, even if they never actually had relations, and then they get divorced or he drops dead. So now, if she wants to marry someone else, so her ksuba will be 100 and not 200. Even if she's physically still a virgin, she's considered halachically not anymore. Because she had, once you have the full
stage. What?
Zuz.
Oh, money.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have the full marriage, then that's considered to be a consummation sort of de facto. And for certain halachas, it won't be that way, including this one, that if they had full nisuin, so the Kohen will not receive malchus for violating this prohibition unless they actually had relations. Mishor she'a mitzvah, the reasoning is as follows. L'fisha kohanim nivcharu lavod avodas Hashem, tamid. The kohanim are specifically designated for the worship of God. Royu mechuyav liosam kedoshim munakiyam yosar mikol sharam b'chol inanayam. They have a higher level of purity, not in the Tumah Vatara, but in the way they are perceived, the way they act, than other Jews. Afki binyan hazivog shudavar ikari badam. So one of the main things about a person's life is his marital life. Uktsas machshavos adam al bazugo tamid. So a person is always thinking about his spouse. Aww, isn't that sweet? So husband walks by a store and sees flowers, is immediately thinking, oh, my wife would like those, and is going to buy them and take care of. My wife doesn't like flowers, so I'm put the phone. L'chein ischayev shelo lisa hazona shemizga ra'umar pentesirenu v'tatenu barov likha midarko atova kavanosu v'tzuya. So a woman who's promiscuous, again, we'll see that in a minute, doesn't necessarily mean what we consider to be a prostitute. Somebody, a woman who sells herself for money, but that's not what it means over here, zona. But somebody who's sleeping with people she shouldn't be sleeping with, then she's not going to have proper mental perspectives on things, so therefore she could influence him badly. V'gam hi boshes ufgam el kol ha'kare v'le'a, so she brings shame to whoever comes to her. She'kol ha'am meranenim achareha betumasa asher b'shuleha, that everybody's running after her, that she's a harlot, they're calling her names. But we see that some of these things are not like this at all, but okay, that's what they say.
Why is this a Kohen? why
should be anyone.
It should be anybody.
But let's say you have a zona who wants to do tshuva, so she shouldn't have and no one should be available to her. No, yeah, somebody has to be available. It's not a Kohen. The Kohen has to hold himself to a higher standard.
Just, okay, the higher thing about how the Kohen, you know, can't have any mum, can't, and so on and so forth. There is other things.
Right,
you know, perfectly okay for anybody else. But
right, 100%. Midine amitzvah lochos are as follows. Masha Amru, Zichronim Livracha, that the sages tell us, Shazona Amura Khan. He? What's that? Does it mean? Kol She'ena Bas Yisrael. Any woman who is not Jewish. Huh? The Chulan Bichlal Zonos Hein. All non-Jewish women are considered to be harlots. Okay? And it's interesting that in the later printings of the Sefer HaChinuch, they had to censor this, and they changed the Hain to Hayu. That in the olden days, non-Jewish women used to be promiscuous. Nowadays, they're mamish tzadikos, that they're completely fine. Anyway, they're real text.
But we still don't let them marry or whatever.
Right, so the real version of Sefer HaChinuch is that they currently are still, all non-Jewish women are halachically de facto, she could be the most pure woman in the world. She could be Mother Teresa. Right. She could be Mother Teresa. She could be...
She could convert.
Right. But she, nevertheless, halachically, she's considered to be a zona. The Ode, Shekevan She'en Kiddushin Tovsin Bahen Zimahi. And since it's something that where you could not marry this person, a Jewish person cannot marry a non-Jewish woman, so therefore it's considered to be highly inappropriate and bad if a woman who, for a non-Jewish woman, she's in the category of a zona de facto because she can't marry a Jewish person. So if a Jewish person has relations with her, that's by definition considered znus. Doesn't mean what's a better word? Not harlotry in the sense that money is exchanged over here. It just means that it's a... what's a good word?
Profoundly non-sneezy.
This has to be some fornication, I don't know, something like that. Doesn't apply. Something that doesn't apply money just implies that it's an improper relation. Right. Has to be a... Like there should be a particular word for it. V'chein tikare zona kol bas Yisrael shenivala la'adam shehi asura linoselo. Isur hashove bakol. So again, a Kohen is not allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman anyway, but if he does, so he has the additional prohibition of a zona. And it's interesting that this is one of the few cases that Sefer HaChinuch told us before, that in order to be liable for this prohibition, the Kohen has to marry her and then have relations. But here, marriage is impossible, because marriage cannot be contracted between a Jew and non-Jew. So here, just the relations is sufficient for the Kohen to receive the lashes of sleeping with a zona.
So isn't a Jewish woman who has relations with a non-Jew?
V'chein tikare zona kol bas Yisrael sheniva la'adam shehi asura linaselo iser hashave bakol. So any Jewish woman who has ever slept with a man that it is not allowed for any Jewish woman to marry, la'puke amana sheniva la'kohen gadol grusha la'kohen hedyet, so she will be considered a zona for this purpose. So this does not apply to a widow who had relations with a Kohen Gadol, or a divorced woman who had relations with a regular Kohen, because they're allowed to marry regular Jews. So it applies only to a woman who has relations with a man that she would never be allowed to marry. She'ein iser zeh shaveh b'chol adam v'ein anasi zona b'chach. So, for example, since these prohibitions are not, a grusha for a Kohen Hedyot and an amana to Kohen Gadol, so those are not for everyone. So therefore, such a relationship does not render her a zona. Okay? There might be other problems, but for the prohibition of zona, it is not a problem. So, for example, if a woman had relations with a non-Jew, so that's a very common case nowadays, that we have a problem that this woman is now halachically considered to be a zona, and she's not allowed to marry a Kohen. I'll tell you a story that Rabbi Brander told us in one of our practical rabbinics classes. Rabbi Kenneth Brander, formerly the rabbi of Boca Raton, Florida. And he said that in his shul, there's a shul, and there's a little kolel in the shul. So there was a man in the community who started davening with a kolel. He was close to Rabbi Brander also, but most of the time he was davening with a kolel. He started learning with a kolel. So all of a sudden, one yontif, Rabbi Brander, who also happens to be a Kohen himself, Rabbi Brander noticed that this man was duchening. He was a Baal Tshuva. This man and his wife were both Baalei Tshuva, very gung-ho about it. So he noticed that this man was duchening. Went over to him afterwards, he says, excuse me, why were you duchening? So he says, oh, I looked into a little bit about my ancestry. I have such and such proofs. So one, this Kolel fellow that I'm learning with told me that I can consider myself a Kohen. I have these little proofs that I'm a Kohen, and I'm really a Kohen. I consider myself a Kohen. So Rabbi Brander went over to this Kolel fellow. He says, this is not a shaila for a little avrich in Kolel to determine that this person is right. Determine that this person is a Kohen or not. This is a serious shaila that has to be brought to a very big time rabbis. He says, think about it. This man and his wife, they're both Baalei Tshuva. They both went to secular college. What are the chances? What are the chances that his wife has never slept with a non-Jew? If she has even once slept with a non-Jew, they have to get divorced now. That's basically what you just paskin for him. So, I mean, this psak was obviously not binding. This person didn't know what he was doing. I mean, I hope they worked out the situation. I hope they figured out that the fellow really didn't have to consider himself a Kohen. But it does create a lot of problems.
There's one case, actually, of a, there's a girl who's a Baal Tshuva who wanted to marry a Kohen, and she admitted that that once in her life she had a very brief affair with a French policeman. And she didn't know if he, the guy was Jewish or not. She had a quick looking up, what proportion of Parisian policemen are Jewish? And started calculating out percentages and so forth.
Probably not very good.
Yeah, I don't know what the
I don't think this, I doubt that story had a happy ending.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Well, not necessarily. You also have a problem. Oh, that let's say this is also a common problem that comes up. So there is a woman who wants to marry a regular Jew, regular couple getting married for the first time, and the woman is maybe a Baal Tshuva, maybe had a little slip up. So she has had relations with a non-Jew before. And, you know, they discuss it. You know, everybody knows what's going on. Hopefully only the Misadre Kiddushin and the husband and the wife. Maybe the... No, no problem.
Whatever.
But very few people know about it. But they've decided they want... so as not to embarrass the woman, they want to write in the ksuba, Lahada Besulta. And say, virgin. They want to write in the ksuba that the bride is a virgin, even though they agree that she's not. So as long as the husband knows about it, then you're allowed to write it. Maybe. For this purpose, so you're allowed to write it, because basically all virgin indicates is that she gets more money in the ksuba, so the husband can say, okay, I'm voluntarily giving her the ksuba of a besula, of a virgin, even though she's really not, but I admit that, and okay, I'm okay with that, and I'm giving her the higher level of the ksuba anyway. But you still have a problem if she had relations with a Jew. So, no problem. So, you can still, if the write Besulta in the Ksuba, no problem. But if she had relations with a non-Jew, then you do have a problem writing Besulta in the Ksuba, because what happens if the following scenario? This couple lives, regular Jew, marrying this woman who had relations with a non-Jew, writing the Ksuba Besulta. They live happily ever after for 50 years, and the husband dies. And now, the widow wants to marry a Kohen. So the Misadre Kiddushin for the second wedding with this widow and the Kohen thinks, oh, the woman's a widow. She's allowed to marry a Kohen. Says, can I please see your ksuba? So they pull out the first ksuba. It says, Lahada Besulta, virgin. Ah, it was a virgin. She got married. The husband died. Perfect. She's allowed to marry a Kohen.
At this point, her childish into the other.
What?
Her youthful indiscretion, she probably forgotten.
Right. So that's a serious problem. That's why if the... bride is not allowed to marry a Kohen, then you are not allowed to write Besulta in the Ksuba, even if the husband and wife both agree to it. Because you have to know that something is going on. You don't have to say, you know, in the Ksuba she had relations with a non-Jew, and therefore I'm not writing Besulta, but you just have to write, you leave out the word Besulta, and then any Misadre Kiddushin from a second wedding is going to know something is up and is going to investigate further.
When you read it out loud.
Yes.
Right. But when you 100%. 100%. When you read the ksuba out loud, you can substitute Besulta. Uh-huh. You tell the person reading it aloud to say Besulta so they're not embarrassed publicly. Most people don't pay attention anyway. I've heard it at a wedding.
Widow's allowed to marry Cohen.
Yeah, widow's allowed to marry. Just not Grusha. So this is, I have a worse situation where I have a relative whose wife was previously married to a non-Jew. She was previously married, so it's public. Everybody knows that she had relations with a non-Jew. It's nothing. There's nothing she can keep secret. And nevertheless, the liberal rabbi who performed their wedding wrote in there. I've seen the ksuba. It's hanging in her apartment. Hada besulta. It's not proper. Yes. It's absolutely absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, fine. So that's a din. We have to be careful when a kohen dates baal teshuva. You have to be very careful to make sure that such a thing didn't happen in the past. Yeah.
Small objection. I understand. You know. Oh, they both went to secular colleges.
Blah, yeah.
But it's really not fair to tar everybody who went to a secular college with that brush. That you assume that they were.
Well, some poskim do actually. There are poskim that say we don't believe her. Once a woman sets foot in a secular college, she's
City good. College.
Once a okay, you can. There are again. I'm not saying we go like this. I'm not saying practically. I'm saying there are poskim who say that once a woman sets foot in a secular college, she cannot marry a cohen. She's assumed to be sleeping
around. Even in the Antioch of the 1960s, there were a sizable number of people who.
Again, you have to use some seichel. If she's a woman from, you know, from Borough Park, and she's going home every night from City College, so it's different. But if she's sleeping over away from everyone in secular college, okay, you have to figure out the situation. But these are very sensitive shalas in the task because it's a very serious problem for a kohen to choose.
What's there?
I don't know. Maybe one of the last places I've had a kid.
So if she had relations with a cholol, which is the product of a kohen with a woman that he's not allowed to marry. So a kohen marries a divorcee, and they have a child. So the child is not a kohen. He's of kohanic lineage, but he's not a kohen. But he's a kosher Jew. He's not a mamzer. So he's allowed to, he's like a Yisrael. He's allowed to marry, he is allowed to marry anyone. Any Jew, and the same as any other Jew, is allowed to marry. But nevertheless, a woman that he has relations with is not allowed to marry a kohen. Shein hayosa zona tolui bebeila shel Israel bebekima. That to a certain extent, the status of a zona for this purpose in halacha is not dependent on a technical prohibition, because they're allowed to be married. There's no problem. It's just if she does marry him, then she's not allowed to marry a kohen afterwards if this fellow dies. It's just considered to be a pagam. Like, it detracts from her because, in terms of vis-a-vis the kahuna, because she was with a man who was a Kohen and had his Kohan, who had the potential to be a Kohen because of his father, but had his Kohen-ness removed because of the woman that his father chose to marry.
Wait, what's the mathematical probability of being one real Kohen left in the world at this point, though?
Well, you have a chazaka. If you don't know about it, you know, if it's really not not remembered anymore, so you have a chazaka, but you're right. The chazaka that we have about Kohanim nowadays is not necessarily enough to worship in the Beis HaMikdash, but we assume that they really are Kohanim as much as is relevant nowadays. Sort of. Yeah. So Leviim, it's a shail also, because Leviim also in Eretz Yisrael, so they have to be given the Maisa Rishon, that they have to tithe the produce, and they're given the tithe. So according to some poskim, no, the Leviim we have nowadays are Bechezkas Leviim. They are assumed to be Leviim, so you have to give them the Maisa Rishon. Whereas others say that the Leviim, we don't give the Maisa Rishon to the Leviim because... they're not 100% sure Leviim, so therefore Hamotzi Mechaver Olaf Araya. You want your Maaser Rishon? Prove to me that you're a Levi, and then you can take the Maaser Rishon. But that doesn't affect the Kashrus per se, as long as the Maaser Rishon was separated, because Maaser Rishon has no kedusha. It's not like Truma, so it's perfectly mutter for any person to eat the Maaser Rishon. So it might be stealing from the Levi, not to give it to the Levi, but it's not an issue of Kashrus per se. So there are two possibilities. Either if she sleeps with someone that she's never permitted to marry, or with a Kohen who's a Cholol, again, who is born from someone that whose father is a Kohen and his mother is someone that Kohen is not allowed to marry, and he's of Kohanic lineage but loses his status, that's called a Cholol. So we'll continue next time with the Lamadnu Me'ata.